Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies. I'm Andrew Epstein, and thanks for listening to this podcast for the New Books Network. Each episode, we pick a newly published work in Native American and Indigenous Studies and spend the hour speaking with the author. As the U.S. engages in yet another military campaign, unleashing its arsenal on targets in Iraq and Syria to reduce the so-called Islamic State, professions of American innocence once again abound. Politicians, pundits, and generals plead their case as reluctant warriors, burdened with the heroic responsibility of turning back an existential threat that appeared, apparently, out of nowhere. Mentions of the near decade-long U.S. occupation and its attendant devastation, if acknowledged at all, are fleetingly packaged as yet another tragic example of the American moral burden. This insistence on innocence, profuse as it's been over the 13 years of the so-called War on Terror, has a deep history, my guest today argues. Boyd Cuthran is assistant professor of history at York University in Toronto, where he focuses on U.S. Indigenous and cultural history. His new book, Remembering the Modoc War, Redemptive Violence and the Making of American Innocence, is just out from the University of North Carolina Press. Focusing on the historiography, as opposed to simply the history of the Modoc War, Cuthran argues that settlers, journalists, capitalists, and eventually historians have worked to remember the episode not as a violent process of ethnic cleansing, but a redemptive narrative of American innocence. From the advent of the war in 1872 to the monuments and memorializations through the 20th century and indeed till today, these narratives have circulated in what Cuthran calls a marketplace of remembering. Systems, institutions, procedures, social relations, arenas of trade where men and women, settler and indigenous, recite, manipulate, and even monetize the past and the currencies of the present. At its time, and in the decades that followed, the Modoc War was one of the most iconic, most covered eruptions of settler-native violence in all of the so-called Indian Wars. Yet it's been largely overshadowed in contemporary historical memory. I began by asking Cuthran to lay out the basic story.
So the Modoc War is this little remembered but very significant event that takes place, that begins in the winter of 1872, and it really begins actually as an attempt on the part of federal troops to arrest or return a group of Modoc who have left the Klamath Reservation and bring them back onto the reserve. And it begins just as a skirmish on a riverside that goes wrong, and the Modoc scatter, and they end up killing several settlers who had come out to either participate in the arrest or maybe just to witness it, and they take up a hiding position within the lava bed, a space of a traditional refuge and safety for the Modoc people, and then the military is called out to deal with the situation, and because it's at the height of the Grant administration's so-called peace policy. And a period in which the peace commissions are supposed to treat with Native peoples, the military doesn't initially attack. And what happens instead is a long period after a few early efforts to capture them immediately, What actually ends up happening is the situation devolves into a long peace negotiation. And it doesn't last a day or a week, like many of the so-called Indian Wars happened, but actually stretches out over a long period of time in one place. And so it's heavily covered by the newspaper and the media across the nation. And there's lots of chicanery, which I'm sure we'll get into, around the newspaper coverage at the time. But it's sort of a slow-boiling story that captures the nation's attention and fascination at the time. But the Modoc War becomes a national and indeed an international sensation when on April 11th, Good Friday, 1873, the peace negotiations break down, and Edward R.S. Canby, the highest-ranking U.S. soldier ever die in a conflict with indigenous peoples in the 19th century, is killed by the Modoc. And what then proceeds is a couple months of intense extermination-level violence as the army hunts down and captures the remaining Modoc and eventually puts them on trial and then in October executes the headman.
And at that execution on October 3rd, 1873, you already start seeing the development of what you call the marketplaces of remembering. And very much even in the material objects and even the bodies and the implements of execution immediately start beginning to circulate in this economy. What are some of the things that come out of that execution that begin to circulate in this landscape of memory?
Sure, yeah. I mean, in many ways, when I was looking at this event, I was reading it alongside the really fascinating literature on lynching souvenirs in the South, predominantly, but also, you know, many of these extrajudicial executions that happen in the West. We rarely think about these military executions as lynchings, but in many ways, in both form and function, they behave the same way. And so, yeah, what happens is on October 3rd, 1873, the United States Army executes Captain Jack and several other of his followers in an incredibly choreographed execution. And immediately, almost actually even before the execution, an entire commerce in grotesque memorabilia begins. So a few nights beforehand, they take photographs of the Modoc prisoners who are about to be executed. They are then put into cabinet cards that are sold to attendees as souvenirs. Signatures, they collect Captain Jack's marks on pieces of paper, which they sell and distribute. And then once the execution actually begins, a whole just macabre scene unfolds. The hangman takes ropes and locks of the dead men's hair and sell them for $5 a piece. The audience starts dismantling the gallows and collects pieces of them. And today you still find these pieces of the gallows. You know, some of them were fashioned into gavels that people like the president of the Grand Army Republic for the state of Oregon used as his sort of gavel for ringing in their meetings. And others collected pieces of the rope. And these end up circulating among local aficionados and collectors of things that are of Indian memorabilia that eventually get bought up by state archives and national and university libraries and museums, and they continue to circulate even to this day in the forms of basically lynching souvenirs. And then these images, right? I mean, I've talked about the photographs that were taken. It's not just in the kind of the immediacy of a noose or a lock of hair, but the photographs also circulate nationally. These little cabinet card souvenirs are sent to New York and appear in as the illustrations for newspapers that cover the lynching, the execution. Yeah. So Frank Leslie's Illustrated Newspaper, for example, reproduces these lynching souvenirs as their illustrations for their coverage of the event itself.
You know, I think if we don't think about Indian peoples as targets of these lynching mementos, we also, I think, make the mistake, as this book suggests, of thinking of this sort of grotesque lynching memorabilia as being sort of secreted away in the basements of, you know, crypto Confederates or something. But you have, I mean, you have body parts that are shipped to the Army Medical Museum in Washington, D.C. Some of these become the basis for some of the most respected institutions of science and anthropology.
Yeah, no, indeed. I mean, the long legacy of Indian violence and removal and genocidal policies and its interconnectedness with the racial science of the day is you know, really an important story. If we really want to understand the development of racial thought in the 19th century, the collecting of native bodies and the scientificization of that process is really central to the story, and I think sometimes not told quite so openly. But yeah, the heads, Captain Jack's head is removed and is taken to the museum. There's also stories that circulate later on about it being displayed in Washington, D.C. It's unclear whether or not that's actually true or not. Mm-hmm. There may have just been charlatans. I mean, there's lots of charlatans were claimed to have body parts of the various MODOK people that were executed that day, and they kind of circulate around for about a decade around the country, and I've found lots of examples of people coming to see these ersatz trophies, whether they were legitimate or not. But basically, it's in the circulation display of these objects that really a pattern of commodification emerges. Right, and it's in this way that the supposedly invisible hand of the marketplace, I argue, amplify the economic and cultural logics that were embedded within the spectacle of a public execution, and that it basically in this process transformed traces of brutal violence into commodity goods, which laid the foundation for future historical interpretations of the MODOK War and of violence in the American West.
I think this gets us into one of the central contentions of the book, which, I mean, it's a book about remembering and memory, but it is at odds with some of the memory scholarship as it's currently conceived. You want to understand not just the objects and not just the sites of memorialization, but the lives of the people who produced it, what you call the transformative labor of historical knowledge production. And I think oftentimes we use the term knowledge production or memory production. We don't actually think about the final word in that term, production, as in embedded in productive relationships, embedded in an economy. And this is why you develop a framework, you say, of remembering rather than memory, a verb, a process of doing, not just a static noun of memory. Explain your framework here and what you're trying to do and what you're trying to say about memory.
Sure. You know, this came out of my reading into the extensive field of memory studies, you know, and it's been a very fruitful arena of intellectual thought over the last 20 or 30 years. But it's always something that sort of struck me about it. And in some ways, it's encapsulated by this mad cat riffing I put off on Karl Marx's oft-quoted statement that men make their own history, but they do not make it as they please, but under circumstances existing already. And of course, Marx is talking about class and these kinds of things. But in another way, I think we can think about the actual making of history, that men make their own history, and then they write and produce their own history under conditions that they are not necessarily in control of. Mm-hmm. Right. And this is what I'm thinking here is the marketplaces within which history itself is produced. That whether it's a newspaper marketplace, or it's a stage or a dramatic marketplace, whether it's a touristic marketplace, or whether it's a novelistic or even a historical marketplace, a professional historiography, the demands and the structures of those marketplaces will shape the kind of narratives we can produce and the kind of narratives that will fit and conform to the demands of those marketplaces. And so I think so often when we think about the literature on memory and collective memory, we hear things like tangled memories and cords of memories and even memory boxes or sites of memory. And these are all, these are all treating memory as a noun, that mm-hmm. memory is an object, that when we think about history and the past and memory, it's an object that we should analyze and interpret as an object. But in many ways, narratives of the past are also active things. Remembering is a verb. It is a kind of labor in the production of a version of the past. And as a verb, as a form of labor, that we can study it as a kind of economic activity whose material circumstances shape its outcome. And that's something that I was hoping to explore in this book, is really kind of situate the moments of remembering to make sense of the narratives that are produced in those moments. And that opens up the lives of the people who are telling those stories, be they native or non-native. Mm.
So some of the first people to begin performing this labor of remembering are the journalists we alluded to earlier, who swarmed into the Klamath Basin as the fighting unfolded and made this story into an international story, as you say. What are some of the tropes and frameworks that these white journalists used to understand and disseminate news of the war? How did they tell the story of the Modoc War as it was happening and in its aftermath?
Right. Well, the important thing is to realize is that newspaper coverage, as I argue in the book, kind of unfolded in three overlapping phases, right? And it's kind of important because it's going to actually be the nature of the Gilded Age press that is going to end up determining the ways in which this war is covered. So, you know, to begin with, we have to think about the level of partisanship that had defined newspaper coverage during the 19th century, in particular prior to the Civil War, when the vast majority of American newspapers were really aligned with political parties. This is the kind of classic story we understand of the partisan press, and it remains very important throughout the 19th century. But beginning especially after the Civil War, newspapers begin to become much more market oriented, less dependent upon party publishing contracts, and much more just sort of required to appeal to a mass public, and this ends up driving the kind of news that they cover. But initially when the war breaks out, it's actually largely covered within the partisan politics of the Grant administration and that time period. And so the initial word of the conflict, they basically fight out their partisan battles there. And newspapers from the East Coast and throughout the West Coast send reporters to cover this conflict, which they think is going to be an exciting, sensational event. And they get there, and they're just talking. The army and Jack and the Modoc are just meeting every week or so to discuss peace terms. And so these reporters have traveled all the way out there to get exciting news coverage of a bloody Indian conflict, and nothing is happening. And so they try for a while digging up dirt on the local agent, and they try to kind of see where are the skeletons in the local among the local people involved, but that doesn't really get them anywhere. And so what they begin to do is actually manufacture their own sensational coverage of the event. And this is really shown most clearly in the exploits of a reporter named Edward Fox, who is a reporter for the New York Herald. He's actually the yachting reporter, I believe, for James Gordon Bennett's Herald. And he goes and he sort of models himself as a latter-day Stanley, who's going to go in and find Dr. Livingstone in the forest of dark heart of Africa. And so he kind of goes into the Modoc stronghold, as they call it, the place where the Modocs seek refuge, it's a traditional site of refuge for Modoc mm-hmm. people in the lava beds, but the press immediately dubs it the stronghold.
Mm-hmm.
And so Fox goes in there, and he actually gets the first interview with Captain Jack, and he makes a big deal out about this in the press, and he actually gets some really amazing facts out of Jack. You know, Jack talks about how this conflict was about the fact that the settlers were encroaching on their land, and that the Modoc had tried to incorporate themselves within the local economy. They had tried to accommodate Euro-American expanding economics in this region. They had tried to, fit within the expanding settler colonial economy in the region, and they just kept on getting backstabbed.
Mm-hmm.
And so you really get a glimpse into what are the origins and causes of this conflict from the Modoc perspective. But in the news, as Fox reports it, it's all a spectacle of masculine journalistic prowess. You know, it's all about how brave he was to get in there and the incredible feat of a journalistic adventure that this was. And the story that ends up getting circulated is really about how expensive it was for them to transmit this story, and it becomes all about the journalists. And their bravery, and not about the natives and their perspective on the conflict. And so, in many ways, it was this kind of need to sensationalize the journalists' involvement in the event that obscure any Modoc perspective on what was it? What was this war really about?
Mm-hmm. There are some incredible images you include in the book, engravings from the press coverage that also reflect some of the interesting sort of racialization and some of the genocidal rhetoric that's also existing. There's an incredible engraving by Frank Leslie, The Head of a Nation's Nightmare, on page 58, which is incredibly revealing. And also allows you to connect, I think, this story, this coverage, to other debates that are circulating in the press about Reconstruction and about the place of freedmen. And just to describe the image, it is a white man asleep in his bed, and he is having this terrifying nightmare. There is a naked African-American man with Louisiana written behind him, sort of towering over him inside the bedroom. And outside the bedroom, outside the window, is a Modoc man sort of snarling with a gun in his hand looking inside. What's going on in this image here?
Let's talk about that image definitely. Let me kind of back up a second. So basically that earlier period of manufactured sensationalism that I was discussing, that comes to an end, right? In on April 11th, Good Friday, when the Modoc attack and kill General Canby, and immediately this conflict gets picked up by the press and gets spun into a really amazing sensational event. I mean, you know, in a lot of ways you have to realize, you know, Canby was a declared Civil War general. He was a major general, a very high ranking man. And his death was seen as really an incredible moment in the nation's relationship with indigenous peoples. And the calls are incredible. Sherman and Grant call for the Modoc's, quote, utter extermination. I mean, this is written in the newspaper, mm-hmm. right? You will be fully justified in their utter extermination. And there's a couple famous engravers that show up and start producing images after the fact that portray Native people as these savage monsters. And there's even another one later on that shows actually depicts Native Modocs as bugs, you know, to be exterminated, mm-hmm. bed bugs. There's one image of a Uncle Sam hunting the Modoc fleas in his lava bed, and it's actually in his bed, you know. And so this kind of discourse of extermination and of savagery becomes how the Modoc War is portrayed within the media, and how the narratives then of basically to justify their violence because of this savage betrayal on the part of the Native peoples. But at the same time, there are other events unfolding within the nation as well. So the Modoc kill Canby on Friday, Good Friday. On Sunday, the Colfax massacre in Colfax, Louisiana, really erupts into, it happens. There's up to 150 freedmen are killed. And these two things combine together in the national imagination about what this event means. And so within this image, the head of the nation's nightmare, that's Grant sitting in his bed. And it really shows the central tension that the United States was facing during Reconstruction, which is, what is going to be the future role of African-American freedmen in this nation, and what is going to be the role of Native peoples? And this this image, it really evokes an evolving understanding of the reconstructed nation's future racial composition, right? Mm-hmm. It places the Native threat, the indigenous threat, outside of the house of the nation, outside of the home, and the former slave is within, right? And by, you know, in many ways, by locating the Modoc outside the house, it depicted indigenous peoples as an external threat to the nation, whereas the Colfax massacre and the Freedman issue is portrayed as within the house, as, in other words, the kind of former black slave is a danger that is emanating from within the house, mm-hmm. of American society. So in a lot of ways, this conflict gets pulled into evolving debates about this period of what Elliot West calls Greater Reconstruction, this period of incorporating the West and the South back into a reconstructed union and reconstructed United States.
Well, it's interesting, too, because...
And so the Modoc War plays a really central role in... Yeah, I was going to say, the Modoc War really plays a central role in setting up the nation's perspective on what will be... How are we going to deal with Native peoples as we reconstruct this nation? And prior to the Modoc War, the answer was peace. Mm. Right, Grant said this will be a peaceful... There will be a peace policy. It will be a peaceful incorporation of Native peoples. After the Modoc War, it will be a violent incorporation of Native peoples. And that's what gives us the Indian Wars of the 1870s.
You know, and it's interesting because this is a transformational moment of incorporation, as you're saying. I mean, the Modoc figure in that image is standing outside the house. But when Modoc leaders like Captain Jack and others are prosecuted for murder, they're being, in a way, incorporated under the domestic sphere of U.S. litigation. I mean, this crime is starting to get to be known as a crime, as a sort of domestic murder, as opposed to the results of a international conflict. How is that beginning to unfold here?
Well, that begins to unfold because the question becomes, if we want to try them, so they want to kill, you know, obviously after Jack is arrested and his followers are arrested, they want to execute them. But the question becomes, how do we execute them? under what jurisdiction? They want to try them, but if they try them for murder, murder is a civil crime. Mm. And if this was... So they'd have to be tried by a local grand jury, you know, Jackson County or Shasta County or some local jury. The federal government wants to keep it under their control. And so they want to try them in military court. So in order to do that, they have to say, well, these are enemy combatants. These are enemy combatants of a foreign nation. And so that causes all kind of problems. If Native peoples are domestic-dependent nations, if they're wards of the state, how can they actually declare war on the federal government? And so they have to create this kind of alchemy that transforms wards of the state into temporarily foreign combatants in order to try them by military tribunal and then execute them. And there's an incredible Attorney General opinion written in which the federal Attorney General kind of lays out this tortured logic that allows them to ultimately try the Modoc by military tribunal, and they do, and they're found guilty.
And of course, is this the legal opinion that you end up finding in 2008? Coming out of the so-called torture memos written in the Bush administration and how to justify their treatment of detention. I mean, that's one of the most fascinating things about this book. I mean, you know, as I was reading up until the point where you identify those torture memos as being rested on this legal logic from the Modoc War, I was thinking the whole time there's an incredible resonance. I mean, especially on the question of American innocence and victimization, which we'll get into in a moment, with contemporary U.S. foreign policy and imperial behavior. But I was thinking the whole time, this is just sort of an ideological backdrop. It's an implicit sort of understanding that connects these settler wars of the late 19th century with the imperial wars of the 21st century. But then I get to this coda at the end of this chapter, and it's not implicit at all. It's quite explicit. Talk about finding that in this legal memo from the memos from 2001. You found it in 2008.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I began researching this project, I basically set up a Google alert for all kinds of terms, MODOC, MODOC war, a whole variety of terms. And as you do, as one does, you get a steady diet of pings in your inbox. But yes, in at some point in the spring or summer of 2008, I got a notice that the Modoc War had appeared somewhere in a post discussing so-called enhanced interrogation techniques used on suspected Al-Qaeda operatives. And I followed it through, and I discovered the John Woo's so-called torture memos. And these are, of course, 81 pages long, and it's dense legalese, and obviously thousands of, or at least hundreds, statutes are cited. But as I read through them, there's one really crucial point in which you cite George Williams' 1873 Modoc war prisoner opinion as justification for the use of enhanced interrogation techniques on native on so-called enemy combatants. I'm trying to see here if I can find the actual wording of the use of this thing. He says here, Wu says, it cannot be pretended, I'm sorry, no, this is Williams. Williams says, it cannot be pretended that a United States soldier is guilty of murder if he kills a public enemy in battle, which would be the case if municipal laws enforce and applicable to an act committed under such circumstances. So the Modoc, he was basically arguing, could be legally killed by the U.S. military as long as they were first declared to be criminals or public enemies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the death and murder of these native so-called criminals was not itself actually murder. It was simply a kind of temporary condition of war against what would otherwise be wars of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So Wu kind of resurrected this, saying, you know, that the strictures, this is Wu now, saying the strictures that bind the executive in its role as a magistrate enforcing the civil laws have no place in constraining the president in waging war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you cannot suggest that the president is not capable of pursuing criminals wherever they are, be they citizens or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's using this legal, you know, it's this way that legal theories matter,
mm-hmm.
right? The legal theories born, even legal theories born to justify the use of military tribunals against indigenous criminals in the 19th century can give rise to American innocence in the 21st century. And it's these connections and the continuations of these narratives of American innocence that this book is trying to trace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember when I was in graduate school in the early 2000s, I was asked by one of my professors, Barbara Wilkie at the University of Minnesota. She said, I remember at the end of a seminar, she asked us all, well, you know, we talked about like how, you know, post-World War II Cold War consensus shapes historiography or the linguistic turn or whatever. How will 9/11 shape our historiography?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember at the time having no idea how to answer that question.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a few years after 9/11, and I was being asked, you know, how will the recent events shape our approach to history? And I feel in a lot of ways now that I have an answer to that, you know, and that was the book I ended up writing.
Absolutely.
That understanding the ways in which these 19th century conflicts created enduring narratives of American innocence that we carried as a nation and as a culture through the 20th century and into the 21st century to understand our foreign wars and our wars of empire.
Mm-hmm.
As fundamentally innocent. That's a development that I see happening really around the conflicts against indigenous peoples and their conquest in the 19th century. And the Modoc War is an important step in that development. And it's moments like this that we see American innocence connecting these dual legacies of conquest.
One of the first magazine covers of his time, or Newsweek after the September 11th attacks, was in giant captions, "Why do they hate us?" So it's one of the most actually remarkable things you demonstrate in this book is how quickly, and I mean within the course of years, within the course of months, you can go from this genocidal rhetoric of extermination, active calls for extermination of Modoc people coming from politicians and the press, to what seems like very quickly a hegemonic understanding of American innocence, that the war is a product of inevitable, I mean, perhaps even tragic social forces. That narrative of tragedy, of inevitability, of innocence doesn't just emerge, you know, decades in the future when Americans, you know, separated by generations start feeling bad about the legacy of conquest. It's happening quite quickly on the ground. How does that begin to emerge in the Klamath Basin, those ideas of innocence?
Right. Here, I think, again, talking about the material circumstances within which historical memory is produced, we have to realize the evolving economics of the Klamath Basin in the decades after the Modoc War. You know, the Klamath Basin is an extremely isolated region of the country that was basically committed mostly to local farming for local consumption and a little bit of export in wool and a few other lightweight kind of commodities. But beginning in the 1890s, in the 1880s, there is talk of railroads coming to the region. And this is really important because the Klamath Basin, while remote, is also home to some of the great stands of ponderosa pine in North America, and there's a huge construction boom across the country in the late 19th century, and the forests of the old Northwest are being depleted, and so a lot of these lumber barons are looking to the Pacific Northwest for new sources of timber. And within the Klamath Basin, of course, all this timber is contained within the Klamath Reservation. And so where before the Modoc were seen as a kind of dark stain on the region's history, and the Modoc War was seen as this frontier Indian war, there's a concerted effort on the part of locals to transform the conflict into not a bump on the road to modernity, but actually as the kind of turning point of a kind of collective cooperation between Klamath natives and local whites in the production of a modern Klamath Basin. And at first, Klamath people are willing to participate in this re-narration. There's a famous reenactment of the Modoc War that takes place in 1893, in which they literally bury the hatchet and they smoke they smoke the peace pipe and it's trying to perform this re-narration of the event. And a lot of it's because, you know, the Klamath Indians are just as interested in economic development as their local white counterparts.
Sure.
But a series of events end up throwing into question and then ultimately completely undermining this promise of economic advancement for Native peoples. And they're quite complicated, and I lay them out in greater detail in the book, but they involve things like allotment. As the reservation becomes allotted, there's problems that arise during that process. There's some land claim processes that end up going the wrong way for the tribes, so that by the time the railroad ultimately does arrive in 1909, the Klamath feel themselves to have been completely marginalized and cut out of the promise of economic growth and cooperation that the Klamath Basin is now reorienting it. South, and this results in a backlash by Modoc and Klamath peoples against these reconciliatory narratives.
In that process of re-narrating the Modoc War as a turning point in the sort of struggle between, you know, savage violence and civilization. It's not just white economic boosters who are participating in that rhetoric or monetizing that memory. You also find Native people, and particularly a woman named Toby Riddle, who became famous around the country as Winema, who participated in that marketplace of remembering and participating even more specifically in that sort of civilization savagery dyad, and was able to make a living off of it. Can you talk about her story?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so the Winema story was a really fascinating one. In many ways, she's the probably the most famous name to come out of this this event, and in a lot of ways, she's oftentimes portrayed as a kind of Pocahontas-like figure or an indigenous Florence Nightingale. And she's, and in particular, the story that begins to accrue around her is that she saves Alfred Meacham, who is the chairman of the Peace Commission, that she rescues and saves his life during the attack. And in some of these representations, she's like literally throws her body across him, his body, in a kind of a reenactment of the Pocahontas story. this story is widely circulated and well remembered to the point where today there's the Wainema National Forest and all kinds of landscape markers of her story. But in investigating this aspect of the Modoc War story more, you quickly realize that this is actually the product of an entire stage performance. That this is actually her stage name, the stage name for Toby Riddle, and that this whole narrative of a kind of Pocahontas-like figure is more the product of the post-war lyceum and lecture circuit than it actually is of historical memory. And so basically what happens is after the war, Meacham survives and he puts together a traveling Indian show that is going to perform the history of the Modoc War on the stages of the East Coast. And they're quite successful. But in many ways, Meacham at this point hasn't fully embraced the sensationalist story that will eventually accrue around Toby Riddle. She still performs under the name Toby Riddle. A lot of it is more of the kind of Friends of the Indian lecture than it is actually a sensationalized Wild West show. So a lot of it is about demonstrating their attainments of civilization and lecturing on the sobriety of the Modoc and Klamath people and the ills, the short-sightedness of American policy, and less of sort of dramatic rescues and displays of arrow shooting. Mm-hmm. And while this is successful, it's not particularly successful as a market endeavor. And so by June of 1875, Meacham's lecture company is essentially on the brink of bankruptcy. And it's during this financial challenge that they revamp and recreate their stage performance, and they rename Toby Riddle Wainema. And they turn it into this incredibly sensationalist performance in which her rescuing of Meacham is the centerpiece of the story. And they produce a pamphlet called Wainema, the Woman Chief and Her People, that is basically just a dime novel version of the conflict. And their stage performance becomes successful enough that they're able to recoup some profits and head home. But the interesting and amazing thing about the story is that once it's been created, once the story of Wainema becomes created, it engulfs and consumes the real life story underneath it, to the point where in many professional histories of the event produced after the fact, has no mention of Toby Riddle. They refer to her simply as Wainema by her stage name, many histories of the Modoc War that are trying to draw on the backstory of this character actually use scenes from this fanciful dime novel as historical fact and evidence for her early life. And of course, you know, almost all of it is the product of Meacham's imagination. But it gets written into the historical narrative of the conflict. And in many ways, this is because it's a narrative that that redeems the Modoc War in a lot of ways. You know, in this conflict where two people were diametrically opposed, right? The Modoc people and the federal government. One woman tried to stand in the breach, right? Mm-hmm. And this is the classic Pocahontas story. But she becomes this embodiment of American innocence, and her actions become a kind of redemptive narrative. If only both sides could have been more like Wainima, this conflict could have been avoided, right? And that's a kind of way of romanticization of this conflict that avoids the kind of settler colonial underpinnings of the Modoc War and casts it instead within the culture of conflict paradigm. And it's that reason, I argue, that the myth of Wainima has always stood in for the actual story of Toby Riddle. Mm. And this legacy, we can see, is still written today on the very landscape of the Klamath Basin.
In 1926, the Lava Beds National Monument, or memorialization therein to the Modoc War, is unveiled. How did that memorial come about, and how did that public memorialization remember the Modoc War?
Right. Yeah. So this monument is a pretty interesting monument. It's called the Lava Beds Monument, but more commonly known as the Golden Bear Monument. And basically, what it is just a lava bed, a cairn of lava beds, a pillar of lava bed, stitched together with some cement, and then it has a large golden bear, the symbol of California, on it. And according to newspaper accounts, I can't actually make it out in any of the photographs, but according to newspaper accounts, there is supposedly an arrow embedded within the golden bear. And what it comes to symbolize is that the Modoc War was a significant event in California's history. That the golden bear, wounded by the Modoc, continues to roar on in its sort of majesty, and it really solidifies that the Modoc War was California's last Indian War. But it also, in many interesting ways, also expands the category of who were the victims of the Modoc War. So we think about the early coverage of the conflict in newspaper coverage. General Canby is largely seen as the sole victim of the Modoc War. But in this moment, it expands it out to all the soldiers and pioneer settlers who also sacrificed their lives, and it kind of becomes a sort of much more expansive interpretation of who are the victims of this conflict. Well, all soldiers and settlers who were involved were the survivors of the Modoc War. It has no mentions of the native peoples and who were victimized by this event. And in a lot of ways, this is part of a continuation of the memorial landscape of the lava beds. The first memorial in this region is Canby's Cross, a large human-sized cross is dedicated to Canby. It's a first set up in the 1880s by a soldier whose name is John S. Park, and he writes in this human-sized white cross, supposedly held in place by a pile of rocks that were bathed in the blood of Canby. That's what the one local recalls. He'd written the cross on the crossbeam of the cross. General Canby, USA, was murdered here by the Modoc, April 11, 1873. Mm-hmm. You see already this kind of narrative of victimhood and perpetrator being inscribed onto the very landscape. And Canby's cross becomes a very famous tourist site. Many people go there. It's a kind of a landmark in the region for anyone visiting. In order to promote this tourism for places like Canby's Cross and other sites of the Modoc War, local boosters in the region, in Southern Oregon, Northern California, devise a plan to preserve the battlegrounds as a national park. As a result of becoming a national park or a national monument, the Lava Beds National Monument ended up solidifying a redemptive narrative of American innocence onto the very landscape. in memorializing the soldiers and settlers as the victims of the Modoc War, and the indigenous people as the criminals responsible for this national crime.
Mm-hmm. So in the epilogue of Remembering the Modoc War, you take us about 60 years ahead of this national monument of redemptive violence to a new updated version of the Lava Beds National Monument, the consecration of the Modoc War. And what's attempted here is to include all of the so-called victims of the conflict. So a local historian declared everyone is treated the same, civilians, soldiers, Indians, in this new 1988 memorial. What's wrong with including everybody on the same plane?
Right, yeah. Well, so to kind of back up one second, the backdrop for this whole moment is a kind of multicultural moment in American history, right? So you have the kind of the climate for most people who study indigenous history in the United States will know the climate are perhaps most famous is all for their termination battles. In the 50s and 60s, the Klamath are terminated, and this is absolutely dire moment that has huge consequences for the Klamath people, and they only are actually re-recognized after decades of cultural loss and community loss as a result of termination. They're re-recognized in 1986, and it's this moment of trying to re-knit together the communities within the Klamath Basin after these long times of discrimination, but also of a kind of national mood of multicultural inclusion. So in this monument, it's the first monument that purports to list all of the victims of the Modoc War. So no longer is the Lava Beds going to be a redemptive landscape of white victimhood, but now it's going to include everyone. Civilians, soldiers, and Indians, and everyone is going to be treated the same, as Francis Landrum puts in it. Of course, the actual motivations behind this monument are disclosed in a speech at the same time by the superintendent Doris Holmanson, who notes that the soldiers are quote just doing their jobs, which is an ominous way of thinking about the Modoc War. But one of the things that I bring to bear on this is that in this multicultural moment in which everyone is supposedly treated the same, we actually have embedded within that a historical revisionism that is rooted in the notions of American innocence. Because by saying that civilian soldiers and Indians were all the same, earlier in the book, in the prologue, I note that there's also a sign in the National Park that says there were no winners and there were no losers in this war, right? Well, there clearly were winners, and there were clearly losers. And the civilian soldiers and Indians are not all the same, right? That it's within this monument of multicultural inclusion that we have what I call the violence of equality, right? It's just ways in which by ignoring the inequality of the past in the name of contemporary reconciliation, that we actually promulgate narratives of American innocence. Multiculturalism's desire to locate inequality within a distant past is actually part of American innocence, right? Mm-hmm. And so by presenting this memorial as one that treats everyone the same, I argue that this is a kind of exchanging gifts for the dead. And here I'm picking up off the old anthropological concept of the gift, in which a reciprocal exchange is made. And so here the memorialists who built this monument said, we're going to give you the gift of inclusion onto this memorial landscape. We're going to recognize that there were Modoc victims. And in exchange for that, you are obligated to forgive all the history of violence and of discrimination and of memorial violence, right, of innocence. You are to forgive this history of innocence that has shaped memory within this area. It's in these ways that a multicultural marketplace of remembering sets up a really unfair exchange. That we're asked to do. We ask the living to make a gift in the present to the dead in the past. You know, justice, reparation, reconciliation, these are the currencies with which we make deals with the dead and seek to trade their death for our forgiveness. And at the end of the day, I'm actually quite, you know, I'm quite dubious the power of equality as a solution to the violence of the past. Hmm. And there are many ways in which to continue, but I'll try to kind of deconstruct how even in this moment of multicultural inclusion, we actually have at its heart a narrative of American innocence.
Mm. I want to take a step back for a moment and ask you how you came to write this book. I mean, how you came to think about the Modoc War, not just in telling a story of the war, but telling a history of the history. Was there something, was there a moment for you or a series of moments, either in dealing with the landscape there or with the historiography that you read, that made you want to make this particular kind of intervention?
Yeah. You know, I thought about that a lot because I can't really point to a single moment about how this book came about. I guess one of the things is that as a kid, and as a young adult, I admit it, not necessarily proud of it, but I admit that I was a kind of military history buff, Civil War history, the Indian Wars of the 19th century. But in a lot of ways, the part of the book that always excited me the most was that last chapter. There's always seems that in the genre of these books, there's always that last chapter where they talk about all the kind of memories and kind of, you know, novels that were written about it and landmarks that were written. And I was always really engaged by the aftermath of these conflicts and the kind of cultural impact they've had. And in some ways, I always wanted that sort of spun out that last chapter of the of any military history that kind of deals with, you know, its contemporary impact on popular culture and these kind of things. So I was always interested in, or that's one of the things that made me interested in exploring the memorial legacy of a conflict like the Modoc War. But the more, I think, the more important contribution that this book makes is this argument about American innocence, right? And how in the 19th century Americans became committed to the script of understanding their conflicts as fundamentally innocent, particularly the conflicts of empire and conquest. And in that way, I think it really was my engagement with just the Modoc War, because it's such an incredible conflict that is bathed in these notions of innocence. Canby's death on Good Friday really just captured the imagination of a lot of people to make references to Christian martyrdom and sacrifice. The subsequent trial of the Modoc on criminal charges, and you know they're convicted on for murder in violation of the law of war. It's just heavily inflicted with these narratives about criminality and innocence in a way that other conflicts, because of their innate injustice, are harder to maintain in American society. So very few people will kind of make the argument that the Camp Grant victims or the Sand Creek victims deserved it because they were criminals. I mean, of course that's out there, but that's hard to be maintained in a legitimate way. Whereas you still hear people to this day say, well, you know, the Modoc, it was an injustice, but at the end of the day, they were murderers. You know, that is still a kind of narrative that can be logically maintained, and that really is an interesting. Mm-hmm. That's interesting to me, and so I wanted to kind of explore that to some extent, and the product of this book.
Mm. And not even, I imagine, even more so, or alongside people who will say, yeah, but they were murderers. I think you trace this as well. People will say, well, you know, their time had come, and you know, it was an inevitable process. You know, I think that for many Americans now, the idea that settler colonial violence, so they wouldn't use that term necessarily, was tragic, or what, let me put it, you know, in the way that I imagine it comes up most is, you know, what happened, past tense, to Indians was tragic, yes. But encoded in that tragedy is inevitability. And if something is inevitable, nobody is culpable.
Well, I mean, that kind of, the retreat to the tragical and the inevitable is ultimately, I think, the product of American innocence, right? It's the way that we think about these events. Because if it was ultimately a tragedy, or if it was ultimately inevitable, then responsibility is dispersed, if not completely displaced. And so it is in that way that we think about, and here we're stepping beyond the Modoc War, but U.S. Indian violence and the conquest of indigenous peoples in the 19th century more generally as inevitable, that we reaffirm and naturalize narratives about American innocence. And that then gets kind of, it's really interesting that the entire 19th century expansion, U.S. expansion, is bathed in narrative of American innocence. I mean, what is Manifest Destiny other than a narrative of American innocence? The very fact that we don't think about the U.S.-Mexico War within the realm of American foreign policy, but as a kind of domestic conflict and a sort of completion of a process that was preordained. These are stories that we still tell to this day. When people say, you know, the United States has never conquered another people, which I've heard people say, you know, in my classroom. Mm-hmm. These are the legacies, I think, of a kind of way of viewing American history through the lens of innocence that we need to reckon with still. And I think we still need to write more histories that seek to understand and explain this enduring American cultural and historical lens. And I think that this is where indigenous history can be a really powerful way of exploring the role of innocence in American history more generally. Because I think it is in the conflict with indigenous people. It is in making sense of our settler colonial heritage that Americans have most deeply wedded themselves to the narrative of innocence.
I've been speaking with Boyd Cuthran. He's the author of Remembering the Modoc War, Redemptive Violence and the Making of American Innocence. It's just out from the University of North Carolina Press. Before I let you go today, Boyd, I want to ask, and congratulations, of course, on this achievement, but I know you're probably thinking about the next project. Can you tell us anything about what you're working on next?
Sure. Yeah, well, it's still in the kind of development process, so I don't want to kind of get too far ahead of myself here, but mm-hmm. but basically, I'm interested in looking at turning my hand a little bit more towards some popular history, and thinking about ways of expanding a critical historical narrative to a broader American audience. And in particular, I'm interested in this period. What I'm working on now is going to be an outgrowth of this book, and thinking about Reconstruction. You know, so we talked a little bit about how this conflict fits within Reconstruction. I'm currently working on an idea about how to tell stories about the making and the unmaking of Reconstruction that really centers U.S. Indian violence within in the American West, within the larger issues around Reconstruction that have been more traditionally told. And so I'm hoping to have something a little more solid in the next couple of months. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely going to be an outgrowth of this, and I'm definitely hoping it will be something that will have a wide audience of readers inside and outside the academy.
Well, you know, as I mentioned to you before we started our interview, you now have an entire roadmap for what not to do in talking about at least the Modoc War.
You're well primed
not to fall into the traps that historians have been falling into for a good deal of time now.
Well, yeah. Well, we'll see, right? Mm-hmm. Let's see what happens in a few years. I'll have to write a South essay in which I criticize my own mm-hmm. narrative. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that. But hopefully this book will be a good primer for how to write histories of violence in a way that isn't reproducing a narrative of American innocence.
Boyd Cutson, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Andrew.
You've been listening to a discussion with Boyd Cutson, assistant professor at York University and author of Remembering the Modoc War, Redemptive Violence and the Making of American Innocence from the University of North Carolina Press. You can find us on the web at newbooksinnativeamericanstudies.com, where you can listen to all of the past podcasts. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and iTunes. For the New Books Network, I'm Andrew Epstein. Thanks for listening.